Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Hannah Dorr from NASHBE, and welcome to today's webinar. Before we get started, I'd like to go over just a few logistics. Lines will remain muted for the duration of today's webinar. If you'd like to ask a question or leave a comment, please use the chat box on the lower left-hand side of your screen. The chat box will not be seen if you're in full screen mode, so please make sure you exit out of full screen mode if you'd like to ask a question or leave a comment. You'll also need to exit out of full screen mode to participate in polling questions throughout the webinar. After the meeting's over, please complete the evaluation that will pop up. This will allow us to continue to improve your experience. And with that, I'll hand it over to Melanie Brown from CMS.
Thanks, Diana. Welcome, everyone, to today's webinar on using data to identify housing needs and target research. I'm Melanie Brown, a technical director at CMS in the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services, and I work with the Medicaid Innovation Accelerator Program, or IAP. And we're going to kick off today by trying to get a better sense of who we have joining us in the audience. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melanie Stearns from IBM Watson Health for a polling question.
Hello, thank you for joining us. So who are you that's joining us today? If you could just take a minute to mark one of these organizations that shows up on your screen there. We'll give you a couple minutes to do that, and then we will close the poll. It looks like the responses have slowed down. So we'll close the poll, and you should be able to see now. Well, lots of folks from state housing and Medicaid agencies, which is great, very appropriate for this webinar, and then a number of local and regional housing authorities and organizations and advocacy. So a good mix of people on the phone. Thank you all for taking your time to join us. We really appreciate that. And Melanie Brown will now share with us some background and other information. Melanie?
Thanks, Melanie. So the purpose of today's webinar, we hope that participants will walk away having learned more about the advantages of using data to identify needs and to prioritize housing resources. We also hope to help you better understand the range of data systems that are available for data matching and targeting, as well as to help you become more familiar with specific examples of cross-system data matching and targeting and how you might apply those examples to your state. So the agenda for today, we're going to start by providing a very brief overview of the Innovation Accelerator Program's Medicaid Housing Agency Partnerships Track. We'll then have someone discuss the framework for cross-system data analysis and targeting. And then you'll hear some specific examples from Connecticut, Michigan, and Massachusetts about their experience with data matching and targeting. We'll then have some time for questions and answers. We'll have a brief discussion about sort of key takeaways from today's webinar, followed by closing comments. So just to provide a little bit of background, IAP has offered technical support to two cohorts of states in 2016 and 2017. In 2016, those states were California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Illinois, Kentucky, Nevada, New Jersey, and Oregon. And the 2017-18 cohort was Alaska, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nebraska, Texas, Utah, and Virginia. Those states received technical support using standard tools to help them identify goals and current resources and create an action plan that was really focused on how to expand access to community integration for Medicaid beneficiaries that require long-term services and support. Those states were also able to participate in many cross-state partnering opportunities. So the IAP initiative is really focused on the provision of intensive technical support that is tailored to meet the needs of the state, as well as facilitating the exchange of ideas and learning between the state services. But some of the key accomplishments that we observed and heard about from our states were the establishment of cross-agency partnerships, as well as ongoing work groups that are focused on Medicaid housing partnerships. States were also able to better align multiple existing housing and healthcare initiatives. We also heard that states were able to develop or expand data matching to target resources, as well as examining costs and outcomes. And some of the specific data sources that have been used by states previously include MMIS, the Medicaid Management Information Systems data, Medicaid Managed Care data, as well as HMIS, Homelessness Management Information Systems data. So I'm going to stop here for a polling question. I'm going to turn it over to Melanie Stein.
Okay, so we were just curious, do you or your staff or your department or your agency have any experience bringing together data from across different systems? We have four options there. You know, one, yes, we do that frequently. Yes, we did it as a one-time match. No, but we're looking at this possibility. Or nope, we don't have any experience with this yet. I'll give you a couple of minutes to register your responses. Okay, everybody in? Nope. Okay. Last call? Okay. We'll close the poll and see that, wow, over half the people on the line are actually doing data matching effectively. That's impressive. Good for you. I hope you're finding that a useful tool, and we'll have some good things to share with us today as well. One-time matches, just under 10%, on about 38% said, nope, but you're looking at it. So this is a great way to get some more information and hear what some other states have done. And for those of you that don't have any experience, hopefully today will spark your thinking. So thank you for that. All right. With that, then, we are going to start the meat of our presentation. I am going to turn it over to Kim Keaton, who is the Director of Data and Analytics for CSH. Kim?
Thank you, Melanie. Hi, everybody, and thanks for having me on the webinar today. So it was really great to see the results of that poll. I must say I am pleasantly surprised by the 50% of you that say you're frequently using cross-system data in your work. Hopefully this will be useful for you along with the other 50% that either have done this one time or are looking into it or have never done it. So let's move on to the next slide and get started. Great. First, what we're going to do is go through some of the reasons why it is a wise path, a wise decision to use data to identify specifically housing needs and to use that data to target resources like housing with supportive services. So really, you have four things listed here. Firstly, it can help stakeholders understand the complexities of the target population, both medically in terms of their medical needs and costs, and then socially in terms of their housing needs. This information can help address policy concerns such as rising healthcare costs and rising homeless population numbers as well. Secondly, it can help identify members of a target population to prioritize for housing. So this is specifically if you're looking to target a specific housing resource to, for example, high utilizers of health services. Looking across systems can help to identify the members of the target population for that resource. Third, really sharing data across systems can help improve coordination overall. Of course, there's a lot that goes into the word coordination, but better and improved coordination between the health and homeless and housing systems can hopefully turn into improved health and housing outcomes for Medicaid beneficiaries, homeless clients, or patients. For example, in improving, one example is improving discharge planning, people discharged from hospitals, or improving the care that homeless patients are receiving once they exit. And then finally, sharing data across systems, specifically the right data on utilization costs and the cost of housing and services, can really help make the business case for that supportive housing intervention, and really can often show a potential return on investment with, you know, when you build in some assumptions on what housing can do to offset or lower health costs. So when we consider what overlapping systems look like, it's helpful to think about the impact a lack of housing has on a person's utilization of the health, homeless, corrections, behavioral health, and other systems. In this diagram, this is really a schematic that shows potential overlap between looking across the health utilization data, homeless services data, and potentially jail data as well, with a intersecting population at the center. We know that a lack of housing results in the inability to manage chronic conditions appropriately, along with a host of other related impacts, health impacts. We know that the very nature of homelessness and prevalence of mental health and substance use disorders in homeless populations contributes to justice system involvement for this population. And so, therefore, thinking about this from a social determinants of health perspective, really addressing the housing needs of the overlapping population can improve some of these other system impacts. So in the first poll where people said they were coming from, it didn't seem like a ton were from homeless services or housing agencies. So I'm hoping this will be helpful for folks when we say the acronym HMIS. What we mean is Homeless Management Information System. And this is the HUD mandated database, and the different software differs by region, but that each continuum of care is mandated to maintain. The continuum of care are regional collections of homeless service providers that get funding from HUD to provide those services. They usually map onto counties, sometimes cities or regions, sometimes even statewide, and they're all required to capture data across different providers and different partner agencies into one system. The kind of data that a homeless management information system contains is really service utilization, and the types of services are shelter stays, outreach contacts, entries and exits to different types of housing, and reasons for those exits. These data can really help enhance the picture for Medicaid beneficiaries in terms of providing more detailed information on an individual's homeless status and show where they're staying in a given shelter, for example, or a given housing development, that so health plans can really more effectively manage care for their members by knowing where they are, deploying staff as needed. Homeless data is different from health data in that it is generally not HIPAA protected. COCs, that doesn't mean it's not protected at all, but it just doesn't fall under HIPAA. COCs often, nearly always have releases of information that are fairly limited and that might need updating for specific data sharing purposes. And I'll go through later some tips on how to look for that. So when it comes to looking for a specific target population or prioritizing housing resources for a target population, there are three sort of main methods that are used that you see listed here. And the one on the top is the one that I'm mostly talking about today, and that's where we match across systems to develop a list of priority individuals. This is, you know, you can see how this might play out in a community by looking at how potentially a list of individuals can be flagged in a system for referral, or you can have a more proactive approach where service providers and outreach teams partner to really find those eligible members in the community. The second way listed is another data-driven way in which potentially if there is, for example, an integrated data system or county data exchange, but they can't share any identified administrative data. A couple communities have used de-identified administrative data to develop predictive algorithms that someone is a high-cost user, and then, you know, basically turn that into, in one community, that's something that's called a triage tool. Actually, it's in Los Angeles and in another county in California. That is used when folks show up, and then if folks fall into a certain range, then they're referred for a specific initiative. And then the third way is actually the way that's used to identify and prioritize people for housing in nearly every homeless system across the country. And this is because all homeless systems, by the use of an assessment tool, this is because all homeless systems are actually required to perform an assessment on people experiencing homelessness to assess their vulnerability and housing needs. The vast majority of these assessments, and you'll hear names like VISPADAT or VAT, those are some of the acronyms of the types of assessment in use. They're all subjective on the part of the assessor in terms of writing down and capturing information, and the information is self-reported by clients. It's worth noting that these types of assessment tools that are in use in homeless systems can be enhanced by matched administrative data that can help prioritize high-cost users for specific housing interventions. And in fact, HUD, in their coordinated entry system guidance, in fact, specifies that matched administrative data is one of the ways that folks can be prioritized for housing along with vulnerability and other dimensions. So I'm going to talk about, provide some tips for getting started. And hopefully these will give you some ideas on how to actually start to look for opportunities in your community or your state. And then after me, you're going to hear from some really great state examples of how they have actually achieved some of this work, matching human health and housing data. And so, first of all, you want to really see what's going on already and see if you can leverage any existing agreements by conducting a scan locally to see what's happening already. Can you build on any existing data sharing arrangements? Who has access to any data that's already shared? And who do you need to talk to? If your region has an integrated data platform or a real-time data exchange, you probably know that already, and that's a great place to start. You may not have exactly the right data that you need, but it's a great place to start that often lays the groundwork for getting to the right types of data that you want. Familiarizing yourself with basic confidentiality requirements often feels daunting to people, but it doesn't have to feel that way. There's a few things to remember. So when it comes to sharing data between the housing, homeless and housing and health sectors, less protected data, such as HMIS, would generally flow or be sent to a higher protected data agency at the health level, though it's totally worth noting that with the right agreement, such as a business associates agreement, the sharing can occur in the other direction as well. Secondly, reviewing those releases of information. These are the releases of information that are signed by homeless clients that are presenting as they're being entered into a data management, HMIS data management system. They may need to be revised, but there are some communities out there with really pretty flexible ones that don't always have to be revised. And then third is substance use data to be included in the matching. And so if it is, you need to consider whether requirements under 42 CFR Part 2 apply. For those that don't know what 42 CFR Part 2 is, it regulates the use of substance use disorder information. The biggest difference between 42 CFR Part 2 And the HIPAA privacy rule is that part two requires that consent be obtained before sharing substance use disorder information. It also specifies, applies specifically to federally assisted programs defined within the reg. It's really important to note that this does not include self-report substance use data gathered as part of an assessment. So those homeless system assessments that I mentioned previously usually would not be included under 42 CFR Part 2. Third, you'll want to, if you're at the state level, you'll want to take note of any state statutes that either facilitate or bar data sharing. Some states have protections on health data that are go above HIPAA. And, you know, other states have statewide data prohibitions on other systems data. So, for example, Nevada doesn't allow broad sharing of criminal history information. There are also, on the other side, examples of places where state statutes have been enacted that actually facilitate data sharing at the regional or county level. Florida is an example of that. And then another one that actually didn't make it onto this slide is in California. California AB 210 authorized data sharing at the county level for the purpose of coordinating housing and support services and ensuring care for homeless populations in addition to other populations. And it's important to note, these don't actually change the law, but they do allow for some comfort at the county level to county or regional level to share data. And then finally, you'll want to look for analytical capacity or sort of the who in your data matching effort. And so, you know, matching data across systems requires some skills in matching. And, you know, usually that's using a probabilistic algorithm that involves a specific skill set or ease of comfort with matching programs that might be out there. You'll want to look around to see who might have that skill set and be interested in the work. Some counties or states employ a research and analysis unit to look at state and local data, while others might have a university that performs research and analysis on the same data that acts as a partner in that work. And both of those options are worth pursuing. I've seen both options happen in places. And with that, that concludes my last slide. I guess, Melanie, you want to introduce our state speakers?
Sure. I think we actually might have time for one question. A couple of comments and questions came in the chat box while you were speaking. I think we can take one before we move to Steve's presentation. So, question, beyond just identifying eligible clients and doing referrals, do you have any suggestions for actually sharing pertinent information about clients between orgs? For example, in an asthma intervention, if a health worker goes into the home to do education and wants to provide information with the housing assessor about need in the home?
That's a great question. I would say that a great resource for that particular really health level information. So, you know, what we're talking about here is really the precursor to getting folks in the home. There's an organization called the Center for Complex Care Needs that actually has done a lot of work in that area. I would recommend taking a look at their website and their resources.
Great. Thank you, Kim. And we will have more time for questions, and I think some of your questions will be answered as you hear from our speakers that are coming up. So today we have Steve DeLuella from Connecticut Department of Housing, Paula Kaiser-Van Dam, who's from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, and Emily Cooper from the Massachusetts Executive Office of Elder Affairs. So you're going to hear three specific examples from states about how they're using data matching and targeting. And first up, I believe, is Steve DeLuella. Steve, you can get started whenever you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Melanie. And good afternoon, everyone, or if you're on the West Coast, good morning, I guess. So my name is Steve Dallella, and I work at the Connecticut Department of Housing, and in my role, I sort of manage most of the homeless programs throughout the state, whether it is shelter, wraparound housing, coordinated entry, permanent supportive housing, as well as our Section 8 and our state rental assistance programs. So here in Connecticut, we have certainly had a solid history over the past 20, 25 years of creating numerous units of supportive housing across the state, really to address the issue of homelessness. And as we've become more experienced with looking at supportive housing, we've started to realize what is important is trying to determine, you know, how to best utilize that service-intensive unit to ensure that the housing and support services that we provide go to some of the highest utilizers of the system. So about maybe 10 or 12 years ago, with working in collaboration with the Corporation for Supportive Housing, the idea of a data matching between our homeless information and other state systems began to come around, because we did want to really identify folks that were high utilizers of both the Medicaid system as well as our criminal justice system, to see if we can identify those folks that are really cycling back and forth and that may get lost kind of between systems. And if we could provide those cohorts with supportive housing, we believed that we would have much better outcomes for those households that we serve. So while we were thinking about these data matching processes, you know, we had four questions that we really wanted to look at to see how best to really create our system. So as you see on the screen here are our major questions. And why do we want to use data-driven targeting, and why is that important? What systems should we be using, and what data matching strategies should we consider, as well as how can data matching efforts be integrated into our existing systems of care? So when we look at that first question, we realized that data-driven targeting was really important, because we realized that there were these folks that were just caught between systems. You know, we have a really strong interagency partnership here in the state of Connecticut. We have an interagency council on supportive housing, which has 10 state agencies that sits together. So in discussions as we created supportive housing, we talked about the interaction of one household that may go between 4 or 5 or maybe even 7 or 8 of our state agencies. So we realized there is quite a costly overlap of services. So if we could identify those folks that are really going between all of our state agencies, we're better able to target the resources and actually better able to serve them. So that was really one of the prime reasons we wanted to go and attack that. And when we looked at what strategies, we really tried to figure out what were the systems in which it was possible to do data matching. We all know that it is difficult to match certain systems. But here in Connecticut, we have the one advantage of having a single HMIS system. So we have been able to reduce our numbers of continuum care down to two, and as a result, we were able to actually create just one platform for the entire state. We are a little bit weird because we do not have county form of government, so everything is kind of managed at the state level. So that also really kind of assisted us in being able to put everything on one HMIS platform. And from there, then we can look at our other sister state agencies to determine what are the other data systems that we can look at. And our two biggest ones to start with were Medicaid as well as our correction systems. And this has actually been helpful for us, because this was kind of the first foray into really working together in an interagency collaborative. And it really helped us as we started to think about our coordinated entry system and how we'd be better able to integrate all of these different systems to be able to identify those folks as they come into the homeless service system, and which outcome or which type of service we'd be best able to provide. And we all realize that our permanent supportive housing resources is our most intensive. We also realize that in Connecticut, about 93% of the folks that we house in permanent supportive housing stay stably housed throughout the first year of their engagement in the program. In fact, like I said, we started about 25 years ago with permanent supportive housing, and we still have a bunch of individuals that have been housed for the entire 25 years. So we know that when you provide a permanent rental subsidy with services, the outcomes are quite good. Our recidivism rates are quite low. So we know that we really want to be able to really use that resource and be able to deeply target it to those individuals that seem to have multiple barriers to housing. It's also, like I said, it also really assists us in working with our coordinated service delivery system, because we realize that these are individuals that are bouncing back and forth between systems. So anytime that we can coordinate between systems, we can provide a better level of care, especially when you look at the permanent supportive housing model, in which we really focus on housing-based services. Really, the main goal there is to ensure that the person stays stably housed, because as Connecticut is a housing-first state, we believe that when you provide somebody the basis of housing, all the other outcomes will have a much better chance of improving. And our case managers in the supportive housing system then are able to connect better with primary health care, with mental health, substance abuse treatment, employment, education. And using housing as the basis allows us really to start as a jumping point for stabilizing the individuals' lives that we serve. And obviously we want to spur these lasting systems changes. So we know that when we keep somebody stably housed, their costly institutional stays decrease, and stays in inpatient settings or institutional settings also decreases. So we've been able to really push that system along by looking at a data matching technique. So here are the systems that we really look at when we look at data. Like I said, we have our HMIS system, which we are lucky enough, once again, to have on a single platform to look at the entire state. We also have our state Medicaid system, which also has all the data for the entire state, which also will have information from our hospital systems as well as our emergency rooms. We also get information from ambulances, and then we also have our agreement with our corrections institutions to be able to tap into their data to be able to look at those folks that go back and forth. Back in 2013, we applied for a federal grant called the Social Innovation Fund, in which we proposed to do a data match between our HMIS system and our Medicaid system and provide permanent supportive housing to approximately 160 households. So in order to get started with that, we had to do the original data match between those two systems. So at the beginning, I think, as anybody knows, as anybody who tries to do data, there are always struggles in the beginning of really setting up the processes to be able to communicate between state agencies and be able to share that data in a way that is sensitive to the HIPAA rules as well as some HMIS rules. So as a result of that, it took some time to get our data use agreements up in place between our Medicaid agency and our HMIS provider. And we also needed to ensure that we had to redo our releases of information for the folks in HMIS to really allow us to be able to share the data from the HMIS system if it allowed for a match to a permanent housing or a housing resource in general. So by creating that release, it really allowed us to do this data match in a much more fluid manner and able to move forward with the ultimate goal of housing folks based on their HMIS data. So when we did that data match first time about 5 years ago, the data set included about 8,000 individuals in HMIS, and about half of those folks were also matched in our state Medicaid system. And then what you see here is that really those high-cost utilizers, the top 10%, cost our Medicaid system an average of about $67,000 a year, almost $68,000. And there were also some really high-cost users that we really wanted to see if providing a permanent supportive housing subsidy or a permanent supportive housing resource would be really effective to them. So when you look at the high-cost users, you know, we really wanted to figure out where they were, how often they were also staying in shelters, and what types of services through the Medicaid where they were using. So as you can see here, those folks who had a Medicaid cost of over $20,000 annually, you can see that a bunch of those folks had over half of them had more than 31 days in shelter, and almost a third of them had over 2 months in shelter. So you're starting to see that these are some folks that have multiple barriers to housing. They are not the ones that are quickly self-resolving and getting themselves out of those homeless situations. And now when you look at the types of Medicaid interventions, or at least the type of healthcare interventions that we saw in this first original data match, you see a whole lot of emergency room visits. You have 78% or three-quarters at three or more, and nearly half at more than six. We also see high numbers in terms of the inpatient usage, and also something that is really important is looking at chronic conditions and how many folks have chronic conditions. So nearly half of our folks had at least one chronic condition. So at this point, we had one household that, you know, accrued almost $360,000 in Medicaid costs over the course of a year. So if we can provide permanent supportive housing, which in Connecticut, with the housing subsidy and support services, averages about $17,000, we believe that we can drag down that Medicaid cost pretty substantially by providing a stable place to live as well as consistent case management. So here are the real Medicaid uses that we saw throughout the program. So as you can see, really almost half of the Medicaid costs were from an inpatient stay. So when you really think about how we can really reduce Medicaid costs, this really shows that inpatient stays are also the most expensive. So if we're able to really reduce those high-cost systems or high-cost levels of care by providing a permanent supportive housing resource, we really believe that we can see some significant cost savings. We also see high usage for medications, that would be the drugs levels there. We know that as people also stabilize, we will get them on the medications that they need. So that actual cost would actually maybe potentially increase as part of our evaluation of our SIF program. So when we came up with the 160 units for permanent supportive housing, the state actually invested in the rental assistance program that we have here in Connecticut to provide the housing for these folks, and then we used the Federal Social Innovation Fund to provide the services to do the case management for the households. We really wanted to see what the average decrease in cost would be for our Medicaid folks. And then when we did this, we also wanted to look at some of our higher cost users instead of those that were simply at the $20,000 annual cost. So when we started targeting based on the data match, we really started to look at some of those higher cost users. And as a result, you can see that we really started to focus on those folks that had chronic conditions. So, over 80% or 80% of the folks had at least one chronic healthcare condition, including hypertension, asthma, or diabetes. What we did notice when we do this is the population tends to skew a little bit older because as folks age, they'll be more likely to have some of these chronic conditions. So as you can see, over three-quarters of our pilot were age 45 or over. We also had multiple chronic health care conditions. The vast majority of folks also had mental health diagnosis as well as some alcohol and drug symptoms and addictions. One thing we also found out during this process is there was also a high level of involvement in the criminal justice system throughout the lifetime. It may not have been concurrent with the actual data match, but when we did some evaluation of these households, we saw that over 80% had been at least involved in the criminal justice system at one point within their lifetime. So we can really see that a cohort of folks that are really cycling between multiple systems, and then how can we really reduce costs by providing them proper level of care out in the community. And like I stated earlier, when we provide a permanent housing resource, our stability is really, really high, with 92% of our folks staying permanently housed at least for 1 year. Then we started to look at the decreases in services throughout their stay within the permanent housing program. So as you can see, we had decreases in the use of the emergency departments as the main source of care. So we really were able to work with these individuals and families and really get them connected to the mainstream healthcare resources. We also were able to get them connected to mental health treatment as well as substance abuse treatment and any other specialty care that they may need. Now, the service utilization's pattern started to trend in a positive direction over the course of the pilot. We started to see overnight hospitalizations decrease and ER visits are also decreasing, while our typical outpatient mental health and medical care went in the positive direction. So people are now getting their proper medical and mental health service in an outpatient setting on their terms instead of in an inpatient setting. Now, with that, I will turn it over to my colleague from the state of Michigan, who is Paula Kaiser Van Dam.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone, or morning, as he said, if you're on the West Coast. So we were one of the states that participated in the second round of the Medicaid Housing IAP. And as we sort of participated in that technical assistance opportunity, we put together kind of our Michigan plan, and it was really focused on how do we reduce homelessness, improve health outcomes, and decrease avoidable Medicaid utilization, including emergency room utilization as well as inpatient stay. So that was sort of our ultimate goal. And we sort of really organized our work in three buckets. One was data integration. So how do we do data matching for the purposes of prioritizing and targeting for our high-cost population in terms of a housing intervention? And then related to that, based on some of the data matching, how do we improve data quality? Because we knew that was probably going to be a bit of an issue as we got into some of that data matching. Improving overall capacity. So we were ultimately moving towards we wanted to implement a frequent user pilot similar to what Connecticut just described, where we, you know, identified individuals who were Category 1 homeless, who had high Medicaid costs, high ED utilization, and we provided them a housing intervention, and then to be able to kind of track the outcomes associated with that, and what would that housing intervention do. So we're ultimately doing the data matching as a way to determine the, who that target population should be. But we also knew that while doing that, we needed to look at some overall capacity building things that we wanted. We've been working towards looking at how do we get tenancy support services approved through our Medicaid state plan, how do we ensure that the permanent supportive housing providers in our state are providing high-quality permanent supportive housing. So there's some work being done associated with that. But today I'm going to spend the bulk of the time kind of talking about our data integration and our frequent user pilot. So again, the purpose of our data integration was to improve prioritization for the target population through that. We wanted to see better data quality, reduce duplication, and have higher confidence in the target population. So those were our real outcomes that we were striving for through the data integration. I should mention that Michigan is also fortunate that we have a statewide HMIS system, so we are able to pull all of our homeless data from one system and integrate it into the state, our state data warehouse. So in terms of our frequent user pilot, we are excited to say that we just launched our frequent user pilot last month in October. We're piloting it in three communities in Michigan. It's going to serve about 100 people. Our state housing development authority has given us housing choice vouchers, and we're paying for the tenancy support services through a combination of state innovation model funding as well as some general fund dollars. We've provided the communities sort of a by name list of individuals that were identified through the data matching, and those lists have been provided to communities, and they're currently outreaching and housing and trying to house those individuals based on the list. What I can say is, I'm not going to be able to share impact data with you because we're sort of new to this. Unlike Connecticut, we're in the early stages of a frequent user pilot, but we're very excited to finally be doing this and to be able to do the data match. I'll talk a little bit about what we've done in terms of the data integration and the data match, and then share a little bit more about the frequent user pilot. So in terms of the data integration match, a little background. As I said, we have a statewide HMIS system, which makes things a lot easier for us. Our system began statewide around 2005. We did an initial data match with Medicaid in 2015 as part of a National Governors Association complex care initiative that we participated in. And so we learned a little bit when we did it back then as kind of a one-time match. It provided us some, you know, information and started us sort of thinking about the overlap between high Medicaid cost and the homeless population. And so we wanted to build off of what we did back in 2015. And so we had an opportunity through our state innovation model to do some of that data, to do this, some additional data integration between HMIS and Medicaid. And so we started that work in late 2017. And we're looking to automate the match process. It's not currently automated, but we're looking to do that long term so that we can help provide information back to our COCs to help them refine their prioritization process. So that's sort of our ultimate goal there. Here are some of the key steps that we've done through our data integration process. So we had to sign DUAs between our department and the statewide administrator of our statewide homeless management information system. And so that took some time to kind of work through the logistics of that. But we were successful in getting those done, and we were able to bring HMIS data from 2014 forward into our state data warehouse. We created HMIS ID tables that matched against our state's master person index, so that there were some key things that had to match in order to match against that. And from there, we could actually match it against Medicaid from the master person index. And then we refined targets, refined filters, identified target population, and had to, based on that, update the ROIs that Kim mentioned within the homeless management information system. So the release of information from our homeless management information system didn't allow us to share information back in the way that we needed to, so those had to be updated and readministered with individuals. And then once we had this sort of target list, we shared that information back with the COC. We shared it with our three communities that were going to be participating in the pilot, and got feedback from them in terms of how on target was this data. Were these individuals still homeless? Were they still on their prioritization list, et cetera, and had some interesting learning from that as well. In terms of some of the things that we did, as I mentioned, we did the match was against our state master person index, and we used an algorithm where we matched first name, last name, date of birth, and full Social Security number. They had to be homeless within the last 2 years, currently enrolled in Medicaid, and enrolled in a housing outreach or shelter program within the HMIS system. We also added some additional criteria in order to be participating in the pilot, and that included they had to have a minimum of $10,000 of Medicaid claims in the last 3 years and still homeless and interested in housing. And I should mention it's only Category 1 homeless that were eligible or that we brought into the system. So the initial match was done. It was done because of the size. We exported it in multiple segments in order to be able to do it. It was done manually, so it's still not done. As I mentioned, we're long-term wanting to automate the process, but that's not accomplished yet. Well, that's our sort of next phase. We really wanted to just get the data in first and do the match and learn from it and better understand what we could do and not do. In our initial match, we had a 56% match. So we had some issues. We have some COCs who are entering all nine Social Security, all nine digits of Social Security numbers. So we know that that's created some challenges. I mean, we had one COC where only 17% of their data records were able to be matched. We had others that were in the, you know, 80s, high 80%, some and even into the 90s. So we had a range by COCs of whose data was sort of better than others, and that's why we talked about doing the data cleanup and some of the data quality, focusing on some of the data quality, because there are things like that that make a huge difference in terms of the overall match. And sort of long term, we want to sort of standardize how we do the data uploads. We want to create custom extracts, which we can run on a regular interval. We want to make the data transfer an automated process between us and our statewide HMAS vendor and provider. We want to routinely provide information from the match back to COCs, and also we're exploring ways for our Medicaid health plans to collaborate with our service providers to kind of serve these mutual clients. So how do we ultimately leverage that as well? So those are our long-term strategies. So we look forward to maybe having an opportunity at some point to report back on our frequent user pilot. We're super excited to have just kicked that off last month and to serve the roughly 100 individuals that we've identified through the data matching who we think are ideal candidates for a housing intervention and ongoing tenancy support services to not only stabilize their housing but to increase the and move towards more appropriate use of healthcare. So we're super excited about that. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague from Massachusetts, Emily Cooper.
Actually, Paula, just a quick clarification question we had for you before Emily takes over. That is this pilot just for members in managed care, fee-for-service, or both? And if it's managed care, have you partnered with the health plans?
It's both, and health plans have not been at the table yet. So we did an RFP with permanent supportive housing providers to participate in the pilot. As I mentioned, we're piloting in three communities in Michigan right now, but we are in discussions about how to integrate health plans. And in particular, in our state, our health plans have community health worker requirements as part of their contract, the utilization of those resources to continue to serve this population.
Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Hi, everybody. This is Emily Cooper. I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm the Chief Housing Officer at the Massachusetts Executive Office of Elder Affairs, which is a little bit odd that we're not really focused on seniors in our IAP. I actually chair the statewide committee. Our version of the Interagency Council on Housing and Homelessness has a committee on chronic homelessness and homelessness among elders. And so I have been working on both issues. So I'd like to thank you for inviting me to come today and speak. I would say, as you're going to hear, every state is a little bit different. Our experience, our history, our context is different than in Michigan and Connecticut. We have 15 continuum of care as compared to the one I think I heard in Connecticut. We have no data warehouse, so we have 15 different HMIS implementations. So that makes things definitely a little bit more complicated. And what we did with the data as part of the IAP was a lot less technical, probably a little bit more basic, and we were just getting our feet wet, and it's definitely a good way for people to start, but I would say it has had, though it was very small and in retrospect very simple, it's had a very large impact. So to set the stage a little bit, we did participate in the most recent round of the IAP. Our IAP team included not only our Medicaid agency known as MassHealth and our housing agency, but also some key leaders from our state administration and finance agency and our Interagency Council on Housing and Homelessness. And I really want to underscore that it was extremely helpful to have high-level leadership involved, coming to the meetings, coming to the on-site meetings in D.C. and here in Boston. When you have administration and finance, for example, who are the money people at the table, it's a lot easier to have some of those conversations and to get people to move ahead. All the parties were aligned coming in on that we really wanted to work together to figure out how best to serve our target population. And we spent some time figuring out who that was, and we really were looking at people who were chronically homeless and were high utilizers. And we actually spent some time talking about, is it high utilizers of healthcare or high utilizers of public systems overall? So we wanted to make sure that we were addressing kind of high utilizers that were had a cost across not just healthcare utilization. So the other thing that was in play is that the state has a very close relationship with the city of Boston as well as other cities, but the city of Boston has actually set a goal by the administration of ending chronic homelessness, and the mayor has actually designated a specific staff person to work on ending chronic homelessness. And if you look at our numbers across the state in chronic homelessness, of the about 1,238 individuals who were chronically homeless, about 43% of them, that was from the point in time last year, 43% of them were actually in Boston. So they had a large number of chronic homeless living in the city. We have a history of collaborating on events named surges, where we have brought together housing and social services, particularly those funded by Medicaid, together on one day and brought people, pre-screened everybody and brought people there, and basically they walk out with an apartment and hooked onto Medicaid services with a case manager and enrolled in what they need to be. So we've had a very successful history of working with them. We had people who were key leaders in the Medicaid agency attending and participating and volunteering at many of these events that were for chronically homeless people, and seeing how the Medicaid products themselves were or were not working for the population. The other thing that we'll hear about in a second is that the City of Boston has themselves created a by-name list of chronically homeless persons and is actively case conferencing, so we were able to leverage kind of this relationship. So beyond that, MassHealth, the Medicaid agency, has historically been committed to addressing chronic homelessness. In 2005, there was a pilot developed with a long acronym called CSPEC, which stands for Community Support Program for People Experiencing Chronic Homelessness, and it allowed Medicaid to be a billable service for some of those things that were a little bit intangible. So the special expertise people have that are homeless providers in working with a chronically homeless person and searching for housing, negotiating with landlords, addressing barriers they may have to housing. And then once they find an apartment, moving in and learning things like what needs to be refrigerated and how you don't want to have all your friends over all the time in the middle of the night and leaving the stereo on and leaving. And then continuing on until to stabilize that person in housing who may not have been in housing it for a while. So these services we see as very unique. And although they are offered as part of a healthcare foundation and in conjunction with healthcare, they are specialized CSPEC providers. And that began in 2005 as a pilot. It's since been expanded to other MassHealth Medicaid products, managed care products, senior care products that are for seniors, and we are, you know, working with trying to get this so that it would be available to any chronically homeless person who could be on Medicaid. So that's really shown a commitment that the state had early on in addressing chronic homelessness. So as part of the IAP, we had great help in putting together this pretty driver diagram, which is on your screen, which I'm not going to read to you. You can look at it later, but it really helped us hone what we wanted to do with our time and our technical assistance. It's within this context that we decided to focus on two populations. One, individuals who are chronically homeless and high utilizers of health care, and two, homeless families that are high utilizers when compared to other Medicaid families. And that distinction is because we looked at, we wanted to make sure the homeless families were not always the highest utilizers, but they were if you were comparing them to a cohort of non-homeless families who were on Medicaid. We first decided to tackle the individuals since there was an existing data sharing agreement between Medicaid and the City of Boston from those events that I talked about, those surges. So that was sort of an easier lift, and so we decided to start with that. So going into this, some people believe that, in general, people believed that chronically homeless individuals were high utilizers of health care. And if this is the case, then maybe healthcare agencies would be more interested in partnering around a solution. But there had been some kind of ad hoc, preliminary, informal data sharing that, you know, the rumor mill had it that, you know, was kind of inconclusive. The big shelter had shared some data with the big hospital, and they couldn't find any, overlap or very little overlap. So there was kind of this idea of, we don't really know. I mean, everybody kind of says that they're high utilizers, and we hear or we don't hear, but let's actually look at the data and confirm or inform this hypothesis. So that's the first reason, you know, first thing that we wanted to do was figure out, are chronically homeless people high utilizers of healthcare? And we spent a lot of time even talking about what does high utilizers mean. So we leveraged, as I said, the existing data sharing agreement we have with the City of Boston, and they gave us their by name list of chronically homeless individuals. And then MassHealth, the Medicaid agency, looked through that list, analyzed the coverage status, the service utilization, and the cost. This was not a large research study. This was not a huge data matching exercise. There were about probably 800 or 900 records. It was really a small project that we were kind of saying, well, we can do this. We have the data. It's the easiest thing to do. So this really isn't looking at all chronically homeless people in the state, but we're kind of wanted to get the ball rolling and see if it would help further the conversations. So we looked at the claims and coverage data for fiscal year 2017, and we looked at some trending data looking backwards at Medicaid to get really a picture of who was being served or how they were being served and what the chronically homeless population looked like. So some of this is not surprising, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the specific results, and I'd be happy to share the report. I just want to highlight a few key findings. So the average age of 53 and 81% male, I'm sure you've seen this in other states, and it probably aligns with the national data. We had a large number of chronic conditions. You heard that from the folks in Connecticut and Michigan, which means this is really a medically frail population with acute needs, and it's looking at not just their housing needs, but once they are housed, they really have medical issues as well. Studies have shown, actually, that homeless kind of older adults often have medical problems and conditions of people 15 or 20 years they're older than them. And this seems to be the case in Boston as well. We also, there was a recent study that was released in the Journal of American, in JAMA, that looked at the mortality among the unsheltered homeless adults in Boston historically from 2000 to 2009 and found that the mortality rate was 3 times higher among unsheltered than sheltered homeless and 10 times higher than the adult adult population in Massachusetts. So, you know, the chronic conditions was not surprising, but we also have to start thinking about homelessness as not just mental health, not just substance use, not just housing, but also medical to many extent, which obviously they're going and using healthcare in a different way and how we can address that in a proactive way. 15% of the individuals had previously been enrolled in MassHealth but had lost coverage due to administrative reasons, and that was kind of something that's a little eye-opening and also not surprising, but we're talking about that internally to see how we can the team is still working on developing solutions to that. We have a growing number of people who are enrolled in managed care and integrated care programs, which we see as a good thing. We really want managed care them to be involved in a place that is worrying about them and paying attention to their costs and their needs. And the average per member per month cost was $2,195. This was, I think, the most helpful part of the analysis, to put a number to it. Because healthcare providers will walk around talking about the PMPM, which if you're a houser like me was, you know, took a little while to figure out what they were talking about, and comparing that number to, well, are they community well or nursing facility level or what does this mean? Is this the cost that we pay on dual? So they can, in their head, when we put that $2,000 out there, they ranked that number comparatively to other people in their population. We also broke down the cost into different categories, such as pharmacy, inpatient, non-maternity, and we indicated what percent of the cohort used each service. And not surprisingly, the highest cost services were used by a small number of people. So when we look at the service utilization, we had about an average of 8.4 emergency department visits per year, but we had a cohort of, you know, people that had over 21 visits. We had an average of 2.8 hospital inpatient admissions a year, and then we had about a cohort of people who admitted over 7 times. The thing that was particularly useful, I think, was that we named the providers. We showed which hospitals were getting the majority of the visits, how many, what percentage. We told them, you know, how many were seeing the inpatient admissions. So we named the agencies that were actually impacted by these people's use of ER, emergency department and inpatient. We also noted that, you know, we have a cohort of of chronically homeless individuals that used no Medicaid services during the fiscal year. So, you know, this kind of confirmed that not all chronically homeless are high utilizers of health care. Some are even non-utilizers, but a significant subset of the population are having a large impact on the system and the cost, and most of them are going to really three or four hospitals in our area. And, you know, that was really helpful to see. So what did we learn from this? It was a really small exercise, but it really has generated – it's got legs, as they say. So the first thing is the lessons learned are you really need buy-in of the leadership to make things happen. The analysis itself was really not time-consuming or difficult, but until, you know, you had the right people and key people in leadership positions saying, oh, yeah, go ahead and do that, you know, compared to all the other competing priorities staff have, nobody was going to go ahead and do it. As we've heard, privacy laws make the mechanics of data sharing difficult. So, you know, the city of Boston has releases signed in order to share data with Medicaid, and there's a data sharing agreement, but it's not true data sharing because the city of Boston is not in a BAA with the Medicaid agency, with MassHealth. So we were not able to give them back individual specific information. All we could give back was aggregate findings. And so that made it difficult, you know, and sometimes in colloquially has been referred to as a data taking agreement rather than a data sharing agreement. And I want to say perfect should not be the enemy of good. I know people say this a lot, but, you know, despite the lack of specific individual findings that this, from going back to the city of Boston and then the fact that the data is only for the city of Boston, this IAP team has been able to use this information to spur discussions with hospitals, accountable care organizations, and managed care organizations and other healthcare providers around partnerships to end chronic homelessness. So just to finish, there's so much activity. It almost feels like the stars are aligning. So the city of Boston is trying to negotiate a BAA, a business associate agreement with MassHealth to use data to inform their coordinated entry system and to ensure that chronically homeless people are getting on and staying on Medicaid and are getting the most services that they're eligible for. And even when they are on Medicaid, coordinating with those folks. The city of Boston meets weekly to case conference on their by name list, but the healthcare provider who may be listed in the person's Medicaid record is usually not in that meeting. So how do you start to incorporate that? The city of Boston has used this information to also approach those hospitals. The hospitals are now being offered what they're calling a window into the system. As long as there's a HIPAA compliance, the city allows the hospitals to log into their system and say, oh, there's Joe Taylor, he showed up in our ER, and it says here he's working with this case manager, and I will contact this case manager. They can't write anything into the system, but they can look into it. We are working on a statewide homeless data warehouse, which I'm very jealous of Michigan and Connecticut with their data warehouses in one continuum. So we are having the 15th HMIS will be exported into a data warehouse, aggregated and deduplicated, so that we can have a more robust way of doing care coordination and making policy decisions, and we'll have a standard release of information for that. Medicaid here in Massachusetts has just launched an accountable care organization, ACO's model of care, and they are actively discussing housing and social determinants of health and homelessness. So they have also will be given flexible services in order to address housing and unstable housing. So they're working. There are conversations about how to partner with homeless providers, including the city of Boston, and use this data to help do some hot spotting and figure out where there are overlaps between who's on the by name list and who's on the ACOs, and how to bring them into the conversation to end homelessness. One of the local hospitals actually spent their community benefits money that they're required to spend on all housing-related activities, including housing for homeless people. A large health plan just gave $1 million to the city of Boston to create permanent supportive housing for chronically homeless people. So all of these things are happening to bring this little analysis have brought a whole set of players to the table that were not there before, including ACOs, healthcare providers, funders, you know, a variety of hospitals, a variety of players that, you know, knew about homelessness but had never actually, you know, been active in the solution before. We may run this analysis with other continuums and other cities when they are ready to sort of have this discussion, and we can replicate it and pretty easily. So I think that's it for me, and I'm going to turn it over to Sue.
Thank you. So I think we have a number of questions in the chat. Melanie, do you want to say some of those
sure.
out loud, and we can figure out who should answer them?
Sure. So there were I'm getting a little bit of echo, but it looks like there were a couple of comments that came in early, which I wanted to give our speakers an opportunity to react to. I'm just scrolling up here. So I think this came in when Kim was speaking, and just wanted to see whether or not the comment resonated with any of our speakers. The comment was that it would be helpful for speakers to give ideas about the state's role in data matching, particularly for states where public health, managed care, and continuum of care are all pretty decentralized to the local level. I'm not sure who should take that, but welcome any of our speakers to react to that.
I can answer quickly for Connecticut, but it's not going to be helpful. Everything we do in Connecticut is centralized and not decentralized, so it makes we just all work together as a state because, like I said earlier, we have no county form of government, and I chair the state's largest COC, so everything kind of is extremely centralized for us, so I think it makes it certainly a lot easier. So, unfortunately, I can't be very helpful for that question.
And what about Michigan and Massachusetts?
So this is Paula in Michigan. Our public health and our managed care, I mean, even our continuum of care, we have 21 continuum of care. So, I mean, things are fairly decentralized here. So, I mean, we just decided that we felt like rather than, because we have statewide, the statewide homeless information system, that it would be best for us to try to tackle the data matching and the data integration at the state level and then figure out the data sharing agreements that need to be in place to kind of give it back to the locals, even though ultimately it's their data to begin with, but they don't have necessarily the Medicaid data in the same way. So, you know, so that's how we've sort of looked at that and went about tackling it.
And I think in Massachusetts,
go ahead.
In Massachusetts, we're also pretty decentralized. With so many continuums of care and managed care and now accountable care organizations. But, you know, our state Medicaid agency is pretty involved with all the different healthcare providers. So there's some, definitely some local relationships happening, but we're really trying to see if there's a way that we can kind of push the information out to our providers and get them to be linking at the local level too.
This is Kim, and I would just add to that that is, you know, unfortunately the reality of most states. I think that the state-level perspectives of Connecticut and Michigan that you heard about here are pretty unique, but places are more like Massachusetts. They're more like, you know, California, which has like 30 COCs or something like that, all with different data systems. And what we're seeing is that there is increasingly a state recognition that there needs to be a statewide homeless and housing data source that, you know, can actually look across the state and reflect how people actually travel and use those services. And, you know, so there's more, you'll see more statewide data warehouses coming in the future, I think.
Great. Thanks, Kim, and Paula and Steve and Emily. So another question that came in the chat box was about awareness of states that have an agreement with COCs, Continuum of Cares, to have data from the HMIS directly uploaded to the MMIS. Also, how are state housing agencies identifying Medicaid members in the HMIS without breaking privacy laws or HIPAA.
So I can start with I'll start with that, and then some of the speakers might want to add. But the only example that I know of HMIS being directly uploaded into the Medicaid system is what you heard from in Michigan. That's being worked on right now. That's not a reality really anywhere else where it's an automatic thing. With regards to how can that be done without violating HIPAA, there is, you know, HIPAA is about the exchange, really, of protected health information between healthcare providers and different players in the healthcare system. There is certainly provisions within HIPAA for sharing information for the purposes of coordinating care, and, you know, that's what this is at the end of the day, is sharing information, particularly on just identity that a person might be eligible for a specific intervention, and that is for coordinating care. So HIPAA does not bar that type of sharing. It actually provides allowances for that.
Yeah. Great. Kim, any other feedback from our panelists? Okay. And let's see. There was also a question that came in the chat box about whether or not the sharing was occurring via business associate agreements. Kim, I thought you had answered that already in the chat box. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a privacy lawyer by any stretch of the imagination, but generally when health data is involved, a business associate's agreement is what's necessary.
Melanie, I wondered if I could ask our three state speakers if they would be willing to share any of the data sharing or business associate agreements with others. We get that question a lot about, well, I'd love to see what one looks like. So just wondered if the three of them could speak to whether they'd be willing to share any of those documents that they use for the data sharing.
Yeah, we've had no problem with
that. And this is Emily from Massachusetts, and I'm going to give you the politic answer, which is I have to check with our legal staff first. But assuming they say yes, sure.
This is Paula in Michigan. I need to do the same, but assuming they're fine with it, we would be happy to share it.
And Steve?
Yeah, I think we'd be fine. I think from our perspective, if the state signs it, it is subject to freedom of information. So, therefore, I think it shouldn't be an issue for us here in Connecticut.
Great. Thank you.
So, Steve, while you're speaking, there was a question that wanted you to verify the name of the grant that you mentioned through which Connecticut was able to update software for the data match?
Well, there were two things. There was a Social Innovation Fund grant that provided us with the motivation and the service funding to do the data match, as well as to provide the permanent supportive housing. In terms of the software piece of it, that's something that the state actually paid for, so that wasn't a grant. The state paid for that piece, but the federal grant paid for the support services for the permanent supportive housing.
Great. Thank you. And then this question came in regarding the Housing First model. Could you please describe outcomes of your Housing First model with those experiencing substance use disorders? But I'm not sure which speaker that was directed to.
Sure, I can take that on too. We know no difference between those households that have a primary substance abuse diagnosis versus those that have primary mental health diagnosis. In fact, most of the households we serve are actually duly diagnosed. So there is no data difference between that. So they also, those with primary substance or those with dual diagnosis also maintain their housing at a 90% rate over the course of the year. When we're talking about housing first, really we're talking about ensuring that these households are meeting the basic tenets of tenancy, or meeting the basic requirements of tenancy, such as paying the rent on time and being good neighbors. So we realize that use is often, or relapse is often a part of a substance abuse issue. But luckily, when we have case managers working with these folks, they're able to identify that some use may have been picked up, so we can hopefully put them back into the proper channels, whether it's AA, NA, or some outpatient treatment or even inpatient treatment if needed, to help them along their way to maintaining back to sobriety. So we do not remove anybody from the program if they are actively using, and that is probably one reason why we also see the good retention rates.
Thanks, Steve. So it looks like there was also a question about how you would make a statewide HMI system work in a Commonwealth state. Any of our panelists want to weigh in here?
What are the differences of a Commonwealth state?
You know, so I just to also be clear, you know, Massachusetts is a Commonwealth. We're not creating a statewide HMIS system. We will still have 16 HMIS implementations, 15 at the continuum of care level. We are just creating a data warehouse for those HMIS mm-hmm. to be integrated into one place. So that's a small distinction. I don't know how being a Commonwealth kind of plays into that. Maybe somebody else does.
Well, I could certainly talk about where we were at the state of Connecticut. So we also, about 8 years or so ago, had 13 different COCs in a state that's probably the geographic size of a couple large COCs out there. So we had really small areas and really small communities that had their own continua. So what we really saw was that by actually merging COCs together, we were able to realize greater efficiencies, such as being able to apply for more funding through HUD, as well as not having to replicate the same NOFA application 13 times for a community that may be 2 miles down the road. So once we start merging those COCs, you obviously have to make a choice of what the platform is, because every COC can only have one platform, so that can be a potential start by just starting to merge COCs. And then when we got down to just two, obviously it made total sense for us just to all be on one platform. So in a way, that really wasn't driven by state decision per se. It wasn't that the state said we all must be on one platform. It was really driven by our private nonprofit providers and the COC personnel and the COC leads that really said that this makes the most sense, so that we can really look at how folks really move across the state. Because we are so small geographically, we know that a lot of our population does move between jurisdictions, so it was certainly helpful for us to be able to look at the data on a statewide basis to really see how folks are moving, you know, the total numbers of homeless throughout the state. And I think that has certainly been a really important key for us to be able to look at our numbers and use data to actually drive down the number of chronically homeless and veteran homeless and family homelessness across the state.
Thanks, Steve. Melanie, do you want to ask any more of these questions? I think we have time for maybe one or two more.
Sure. So I think this is one that all of the panelists could weigh in on. The question is, how have state legislatures been helpful in this work?
How have the state legislatures been what? I'm sorry. Oh, helpful.
Been helpful.
We in Connecticut have a really strong homeless advocacy movement. We have a couple of organizations that their sole purpose is providing advocacy to our legislature and some grassroots support for our providers. So they really make inroads with individual representatives and senators from our state to really explain what our homeless service system is doing, how it has been effective, and how investing in this system can actually save costs through other parts of state government, whether it's through Medicaid or corrections or what have you. So I think because of that strong advocacy push, we've been able to make some solid inroads in the legislature to really, on both sides of the aisle, that really support our movement and our work, and they see the results. And luckily we've had a governor who has also been supportive, and the advocacy entities have been able to work with the governor and really provide the necessary resources for us. And in these past, I don't know, 5 years or so, we've, you know, been recognized as ending veteran homelessness. We only have about 28 unmatched chronic throughout the entire state. So we certainly had a great partnership with elected leaders that really has helped us with the resources needed to help push the system along.
Let's see, Emily or Paula, can you give a quick response to the question?
Yeah, this is Paula in Michigan. We've not done a ton of educating. We did have one particular member of our legislature who was actually trying to propose something very similar to our frequent user pilot for his specific district. So we were able to share with him through the work that we were doing through the Medicaid IEP our plans for the frequent user pilot and how we were going to go about doing that. And so he was extremely excited about it and asked us to keep him informed. We are, as we continue to do the data analytics from the data match, looking at how many people, based on the criteria we used for the pilot, would be sort of eligible and need housing based on the way that we're doing it for the pilot, and hope to, in the next budget round, begin to think about how to submit an ask to either expand the pilot or begin to think about another way to go about including more folks. So, and using that information to try to garner the resources that we'll need to be able to do that. So, I mean, we're just at the beginning stages of really engagement with the legislature as a whole.
Thank you. And Emily, do you have a quick response?
Yeah, in Massachusetts, I think we are have also not really actively engaged the legislature. Our administration has been actively engaged and has allocated resources to creating a homeless data warehouse as a result of this. So I think that will actually, one of the goals of that is to put a public facing dashboard that can help with some of the conversations with stakeholders and legislators about homelessness across the state.
Thank you. Okay. I think we need to move along, so I'm going to pass it along to Melanie.
Yes, thank you, Sue. And Emily, if you could check the chat box, there is a question specifically for you. Perhaps you could answer that directly to the person inquiring.
Sure, you want me to do that through the online? Yeah, okay.
So I made sure we got to all the questions. Okay, so this is just the last poll that we have for everybody here. So based on what you already knew coming in, and then, you know, for those of you that hadn't done this or were thinking about it, how likely is it that your state will engage or expand cross-systems data matching and or targeting as a result of this webinar? Are you very likely, this is for everybody, are you very likely to do that, somewhat likely, or not likely at all? And this is not a commitment. CMS is not going to hold anybody to this. They're just trying to get an idea of, is this a direction that states are moving in? Responses slow down, so we're going to go ahead and close the poll. Everybody see those results? Okay. Looks like this is definitely a direction that states are looking at. So we appreciate that, and hopefully some of the information heard today is helpful, and the slides will be, and the recording will be posted to the Medicaid.gov IAP website by the end of the month. And Melanie, I will turn it back to you.
Thanks, Melanie. So just to wrap up quickly, we find that it's helpful just to point out a few sort of key takeaways from the content presented today. So some of the state data matching lessons learned that we heard include Data matching and analysis can effectively be used to identify the needs of target populations and then to prioritize housing resources. There are many different data sources and systems that can be used for data matching. Data use agreements are essential, and you may find it helpful to leverage existing DUAs and to them to update those as needed if possible. You should definitely review the privacy statute. Some will support data sharing, others won't. You do need agency and administrative buy-in and support for success. Analytical staffing is essential, and consider options of partnering with other state agencies or colleges and universities. And finally, data matching takes time. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So just a reminder, we do have a new technical support initiative that is going to be starting in the new year. Expressions of interest from states that would like to participate are due on November 15th by midnight. If you'd like more information about that partnership implementation track, please go to Medicaid.gov. And just to see a little bit more information, November 15th is the due date. CMS will be holding office hours calls with interested states between November 27th and December 7th. Our state selection and state kickoff call will occur in early January, and the official kickoff will occur in mid to late January 2019. So here is our contact information for speakers. If there were questions that you weren't able to get answered today, or speakers have graciously provided their contact information, please feel free to follow up and ask those questions. And I do want to thank all of our presenters today, Steve, Emily, Paula, Kim. Thank you so much for sharing your experience and journey with data matching with us. We hope it has been helpful for all of the people that have participated today. There is a short evaluation form that will pop up as soon as you exit out of ReadyTalk. If you could please just take a couple minutes to complete that form, we really do appreciate the feedback. Thank you for joining us today. And with that, we'll sign off.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect.